Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening.
My next guest is Lorena Warnock. Lorena holds a doctorate in educational leadership with an emphasis on ethics from Creighton University and teaches high school business in rural Oregon. Her TEDx talk, The Other Statistic, was released in 2017 and is viewable on YouTube and explores her philosophy of helping, which emphasizes equity, inclusion, and meeting people where they are. She emphasized also how to help other people who are experiencing trauma or poverty, and what others did to encourage her to see herself as a college-going individual person. Welcome to the podcast, Lorena.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, in your background, I'll have you tell about it, but we'll start off with, before we get to the trench question, a little bit about just kind of your college experience. And you know, you didn't go right from high school into college, and kind of how that got you to completing a doctorate.
Okay, so I was a teen mom. I had my first child when I was 16 years old. I got married when I was 17 years old, and I dropped out of high school 2 months before graduation, actually on the advice of my principal, which is kind of an interesting side note. When I got married, my first marriage was not a fantastic experience. So when I left that relationship, I kind of made a commitment to myself that I would never be financially reliant on someone else mm-hmm. again. And my family, I really come from a family of generational poverty, and they had not a strong support for education as a whole. There were a lot of myths about education and college in particular. But I had always been good at school. So I went to an alternative school to finish my high school diploma. And a teacher at that school helped me see myself really as a college-going human. And you know, she asked me what college I was going to go to. And I just said, you know, people like me don't go to college. And so she proved to me that people like me could go to college in a very unique way that is in my TEDx talk. And I started at the University of Idaho when I was in my 20s. I had two children at that time, and really long time to get my bachelor's degree. It was 7 years before I finished my bachelor, 7 years in three colleges. Finished my bachelor's degree and went out into the world thinking that a bachelor's degree was going to change my life forever. and it didn't. So I went about 5 years later, I went to graduate school to get my master's degree in curriculum and instruction at St. Xavier University. And thinking that my master's degree would change my life. And it didn't as much as I had thought that it might. And then I actually went to get a second master's degree. I was trying to teach at full-time at a community college, and most of that is adjunct. And I thought having a second master's degree would make me more employable at the community college. And one of my students actually at the community college I was teaching called me on it and said, like, I think you're just afraid. You're always telling us, don't be afraid to keep moving forward. Yeah. And he said, I think you're afraid of moving forward. You're doing a second master's because you've already done that. And so you're not afraid of it. And so whether it was because he was right or because I'm just stubborn, mm-hmm. I started applying for doctorate programs. And it took me 4.5 years to finish my doctorate at Creighton University in education leadership.
Yeah, that's definitely the story of somebody who continues to push forward.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes I hear people say like that was very brave or something along those lines. And I think it was just because I didn't know any better, you know, it was, the line between courage and ignorance is very, very thin.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very thin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, congratulations on all your educational endeavors. And I think now you feel like, you know, your life is changed that you have the doctorate.
Yes,
yeah.
I do. Yes. Ironically, though, probably not because of my doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the doctorate was part of that. But the college degree itself is, I think it's a way for us to learn more about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And to learn better critical thinking and problem solving skills.
Mm-hmm.
So while I kind of had an idea in my head that, you know, suddenly I would have this degree and things would change. What actually happened is in the process of getting my degree, I changed my own life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's an important component of education. Is that the process is more important than the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the road that's, you know, that teaches you more than the goal itself.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about a time when you were in the trenches as a teacher and managed to crawl out.
Yeah, so I started working at Roseburg High School in 2014, and in 2015, we had a mass shooting at our local community college. And the shooting happened during school hours. I learned that there was an active shooter situation while I was teaching from a student who had looked at their phone when they weren't supposed to be and saw that on social media. And my daughter was supposed to be on campus at that time. And so I had to, you know, stop teaching, kind of try to help students be calm while also remaining calm myself. And this experience, it was really a triple trigger for me, an emotional trigger for me. Part of it was that my daughter was supposed to be there, and my youngest son passed away in 2011. So I have a lot of emotional triggers around young people dying. And particularly about my own children, my older children. So trying to remain calm, interestingly enough, my daughter had missed the bus that day. So she wasn't on campus. And then the idea of that this could be a student that I knew who was either perpetrating the shooting or was going to be a victim in this shooting, whether that was someone who died or was injured or who was just there, because this kind of violence is so long-term trauma. That uncertainty was really emotionally triggering to me. And you know, then the third part of it was gun violence, as my family has a long history of gun violence and suicide and homicide. So being in the classroom at the time that this was happening with very little outside information, accurate information, having to keep myself calm so that I could be a stabilizing, calm force for my students who everyone in the classroom knew someone who went to the community college. That was really, really a challenging, that day was really challenging. The weeks that followed were really challenging. The kind of political unrest that something like this causes was very challenging. But I had learned some skills because of my trauma. I had learned some skills to be able to kind of keep myself together. Mm-hmm. At the times when I needed to keep myself together. And that's not always an easy thing to do. I think when we are emotionally triggered, that's the time that we are most likely to kind of lose our cool. Mm-hmm. and say things that maybe were not the right things to say in the moment. You know, Brené Brown talks about people in anxiety over-functioning and under-functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we can acknowledge the first thing we have to do is just acknowledge to ourselves that this is hard. You know, this is hard. And we acknowledge that to our students as well, because they need to know that it's okay for things to be hard. Getting through that year, and this year was, it was the fifth anniversary of that. And so our community really, I don't want to say celebrated because that's not the right word. But we, you know, we acknowledged like this, this community trauma that had happened to us. It still is an emotional trigger for a lot of people. But we as a community kind of came together and used that to grow together a little bit more. And so the experiences that we have, these trauma experiences that we have, whether we are experiencing them as immediate victims of the trauma, or if we are experiencing them as educators, we have a lot of secondary trauma, a lot of, and particularly if we have strong relationships with our students, they will tell us things that sometimes we may not always want to know. But in moving through that and being able to acknowledge this hurts, this is hard, this is always going to affect me, it will always be a part of me, accepting that this has changed us in some way. All of that, that's how we get through. That's how we get through trauma. You know, it's when we try to make things go back to normal that it festers, because it can't. It can't ever go back to normal.
Yeah. You said the community you live in, there's been a lot of other incidents, like people dying in car accidents and family shootings, and the school you work at is very trauma ready.
Yeah. And we've really had to be trauma ready. And I think it's important that there's a difference between trauma ready and trauma sensitive, right? Trauma ready is having systems in place that activate when trauma happens. So we know what we're going to do if something happens. Examples of this would be opening a safe room for students, having a plan to communicate with staff in the event that something happened, knowing who's going to talk to the media if something is media worthy as a trauma. Having, you know, like a crisis team on, so these kinds of policies, that's being trauma ready. And our teachers on campus have done this so many times that we really know now what that process looks like before it ever happens. Trauma sensitive is when we actually build practices into our classroom. We build systems into our classroom to help students who have experienced trauma move forward and continue to succeed, or to begin to succeed, as sometimes is the case. And it can be very easy to get stuck in trauma ready. Like, of course we know what we'll do if something bad happens, right? We have, if there's an earthquake, we know what we'll do. We have evacuation drills once a month. We have, you know, here's the lockdown procedure, here's the lockout procedure, all of those kinds of things. That's all trauma ready. It's a lot harder, and particularly as educators, and I think the more educated the educator is, the harder it is for us to look at our practices, our classroom practices, and say, is this serving all of my students? Am I inadvertently increasing someone else's trauma? We don't want to think of ourselves that way. And that is hard too, you know, to really look at, does my syllabus reflect a trauma sensitive approach? Are my disciplinary policies trauma sensitive? Or are they increasing the trauma that students have already experienced and giving them education trauma on top of other kinds of trauma? Mm-hmm. So I think our school is moving towards trauma sensitive. You know, we're moving towards that. We aren't quite there yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are great questions to think of as schools take on that approach, whether it's just being trauma informed. I think a lot of districts and systems have, you know, crisis teams and, you know, who's going to talk to the media type people identified. But yeah, it's actually going down to the classroom level and seeing, you know, examining the discipline matrix, examining the curriculum and those types of things. So, and we'll talk a little bit later in the podcast as well about how people can be more trauma informed, but let's talk a little bit about your writing. So you've done a lot of writing over the years as a means for healing and personal growth. And I'll share the link to the essay I read, but was published by Oregon Humanities. So tell me a little bit about what kinds of things you write about and how, you know, for example, how that's helped you heal.
Yeah, so I started writing when I was very young. Mm-hmm. I would say second or third grade is when I started kind of dabbling in writing. And it was a way for me to talk about things that were happening to me without actually talking about things that were happening to me. Right. So I could use the story of someone else experiencing child abuse. It's maybe difficult to imagine a third grader writing about child abuse, you know, but that was how I processed what was happening at those times in my life. As I got older, I wrote a lot more poetry, and horror is actually what I write fiction. Mm-hmm. And those poetry is a way to talk about the things that have happened and make sense of them, right? Like, these things happened, they created these feelings in me. It's a little bit like X, Y, or Z. And there's something important or meaningful in that. Horror is a little bit different. When I'm writing horror, it's more about, for me, turning things into something fictional, maybe even convincing myself like that it could be worse. We always comfort ourselves a little bit by like, it could be worse. But it also helps me to process the feelings that I've had about the things that have happened. And so when I can put that into a character, I can kind of say what I feel in a safe way for me. The essay that you referred to in Oregon Humanities, that was my first major nonfiction piece. And it's the first time that I really got into, in my writing, into how I grew up and the effect that these experiences have had on me. With my father was bipolar, schizophrenic, and he was an alcoholic. He was a very kind human being, but not a very good father. And my mom, she had generational poverty through and through, and kind of the worst of the poverty experiences that we envision if we think about stereotypical poverty. Mm-hmm. That was my mom's experience. And so she didn't know really any other way to be a mom. And that essay helped me put those things into context in a way that I could forgive. I could forgive what happened, but also forgive myself a little bit for being angry about it. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I'm 45 years old and I'm still pissed off about what happened to me when I was in third grade. You know, and being vulnerable like that is very, very hard. It's probably the most difficult writing experience I've had, other than a a collection of poetry about my son who passed.
Yeah, and it's just being able to like put yourself out there, I think, and talk about just some of these experiences, like you said, the poetry that you worked through about your son, but also this piece. I think you told me this piece in the Oregon Humanities, was that the one that you published shortly after your dad's death, or was that another piece?
After my dad's death, I wrote a chapbook of poetry.
Okay.
And that was published, you know, I wrote the chapbook in about 3 weeks, and it was published 6 months later mm-hmm. by a small press out of Pennsylvania. You know, and sometimes it happens that way where I write something very quickly. And then other times, you know, when my son passed, I didn't write for 2 years mm-hmm. after my son passed away. I just didn't have the emotional bandwidth mm-hmm. to be able to put words on paper.
Mm-hmm.
So I think too, with writing, it's important to know yourself well enough to know whether you're ready to write about, you know, X, Y, or Z.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we try to force it, and sometimes other people will try to force it. You know, like, have you tried journaling? No. No, I have not tried journaling.
Yeah, like that poetry about your son, it came when the time was ready.
Yeah, yeah. It came to me when I was emotionally able to approach all of the different feelings that that come from grief, you know, and sometimes with grief and trauma, we sit heavily with one feeling for a long time, but that's not the only feeling that we have about it. And if we haven't processed those other feelings at all, it's very difficult to write about and have that writing be healing rather than being more traumatizing.
Well, for educators who want to learn more about being trauma-informed, I have a series of questions in this next part of the podcast. So the first one is, what are some strategies to build relationships with young people who don't trust adults?
Yeah, and this is it's really difficult as an educator to recognize that behavior is communication,
mm-hmm.
right? Behavior, we tend to look at behavior as something we need to control rather than something we need to understand. And so the first strategy, and I think the most important strategy, is to ask yourself, what is this behavior telling me mm-hmm. about what this student is feeling or experiencing right now? You know, and we can get a lot from reading, from watching documentaries, but we get a lot more from asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the classroom practices that I have, it sounds strange to say, but assigned seating mm-hmm. is a very trauma sensitive thing to do. If you're a person who does not have connections
mm-hmm.
to be the student who walks into a room and you can sit wherever you want, but you have no idea who is safe to sit
mm-hmm.
next to.
Mm-hmm.
So I use assigned seating in my classrooms, community circles
mm-hmm.
where students have the opportunity. Some people do this once a week, some people do it daily, but they have the opportunity to talk to each other safely and in a facilitated way.
Mm-hmm.
But with community circles also giving kind of the opt-out option for mm-hmm. students who may have experienced trauma that morning.
Okay.
Trigger warnings. I know are very controversial in education circles. And I think some of that is because there's not a good understanding of what a trigger warning actually is. Some people think that a trigger warning means I'm giving you permission to opt out mm-hmm. of learning this. In all actuality, what a trigger warning says is, you know, this is something that we are going to be talking about with this book. English class is a place where trigger warnings are really important.
Mm-hmm.
History classes, mm-hmm. particularly for students of color, And so what it does is it allows the student to prepare themselves emotionally for what they might be talking about the next day. I will never forget it was in a college classroom, but being in a college classroom with students we were talking about food stamps, mm-hmm. of all things, social welfare kinds of programs, and being asked, you know, I'm called on, well, what do you think about social safety net programs, and should we have them, or are people who are on those safety net programs, you know, are they just lazy? Mm-hmm. And for me, it's like, oh my gosh, this whole classroom, is this what people have been doing my whole life? Is like talking about my family in college classrooms. Mm-hmm. So being put on the spot like that, when we think about the fact that 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men are going to experience violence from their partners, mm-hmm. you know, and yet we have books and curriculum that are talking about and reliving violence, domestic violence. Many of our students are experiencing that at home. They're seeing that at home. And so when we say we're going to be talking about sexual assault, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that gives a student a chance to process it emotionally before the conversation happens. It gives them a chance to know what they might say, or to come to you and quietly say, please don't call on me during that conversation, because I'm not able to talk about that. So I think of all the tools that are available for trauma-sensitive practices, trigger warnings are the most powerful. Mm-hmm. In part because they help students know they're not alone, mm-hmm. right? Because when we don't issue those and we just assume that no one in the classroom has experienced it, it actually isolates students who have experienced it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It makes them feel like, oh, I'm not supposed to have ever seen domestic violence. So no one else around me must have ever seen domestic violence. This only happens in fiction, mm-hmm. in other people's mind, you know? And then retakes, you know, it's a very simple thing, offering retakes for students so that they understand the value of learning. You know, it's not the value of test taking, it's the value of learning. Mm-hmm. And one that's kind of tricky, the older we get, the trickier this is. Students from, particularly from poverty backgrounds, they don't have the same cultural capital, mm-hmm. that other students do and that we rely on as parts of our curriculum. We make some assumptions about what students have experienced and what they know. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important for educators to listen to current music, mm-hmm. know what the trends are, and to have options for more positive alternatives for students, like at the ready. So this year, a lot of schools are dealing with the Devious Licks Challenge, mm-hmm. right? And on TikTok. So the more we know about that, the more we're able to talk to students about it, and the more we're able to draw on the cultural capital that they do have. Yeah. Maybe not every student has a vocabulary that's the same, but most of them have heard Old Town Road, and we can make a connection in that way, mm-hmm. when we take an interest in students and be very, very patient. Mm. Right? And with some students, it's like, you feel like you're breaking through, and then they put up that wall again for whatever reason. They could have nothing to do with you. And then we have to wait and just keep trying and be very patient with them while holding them accountable. Right? Mm. So it's very tempting as an educator with a lot of empathy to enable some of the negative behaviors that students have, to just kind of give them a free pass. But when we say, like, if we say you can turn in that assignment late, right? That's a gift. Mm-hmm. If we say you can turn in half of the assignment late, recognizing that something has happened in your life that is making this difficult, That's a gift. When we say you don't have to turn in that assignment, what we're saying is we don't think that you're capable. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's something these students have heard a lot. And so the less accountability we give to students, the more we show them that we don't expect them to achieve at the same level, the more they see us as the people in their life who can't be trusted. Mm-hmm. Right? Because they don't even know me. Right? We can't trust someone who doesn't know and believe in us.
Yeah, those are such good tips to think of.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get back to the episode.
You know, when, like you said, especially with English and social studies curriculum, but just in any type of conversation, if you're, you know, teaching a homeroom class, advisory class, and, you know, give forewarning about what might be coming up in the next couple of days as a discussion, and have kids, you know, be prepared and let them know that they can talk mm-hmm. to you. So a lot of teachers might be working in schools with high levels of student poverty, high levels of trauma, and they might not have gone through a lot of poverty and have a lived experience such as yourself. So what should educators that have a heart for students, you know, from trauma backgrounds and from poverty, what are some tips that you can share? And also, we talked a little bit in the pre-chat about the ACEs study, that, you know, having maybe implementing that a little bit more among the staff as well.
Yeah, I think the first thing is, I think anyone has the ability to empathize with anyone else, regardless of their experiences. The key is that we have to stop comparing severity of experiences mm-hmm, with each other. So I kind of wrote down 10 questions that I think educators can ask themselves to help them empathize. Okay. And these are things that I think most people have experienced. Have you ever had to choose between two important things? Mm-hmm. Right? And if we've ever had to make that choice, then we understand the choice that a student needs to make. Do I go to work and help my family, or do I come to school? Mm-hmm. Do I stay home with my siblings because there's no daycare, or do I come to school? Mm-hmm. Those, and particularly with high levels of poverty, those are things that are happening with students. They have to work to help their mm-hmm. family. Have you ever done something you don't like in order to avoid something you like even less? Mm-hmm. Right. And so for me, it's like, I love teaching. I hate grading. Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely hate grading periods. I also hate doing dishes, but I do a lot of dishes right around grading progress report time. You know, for students in poverty, sometimes what this looks like is, you know, they don't really like to smoke, but they're smoking to avoid the anxiety of being in a classroom mm-hmm. with people who don't understand them. Mm-hmm. Right. They don't necessarily like getting in trouble, but they're doing things to get in trouble because they like being ignored even less. Mm-hmm. Right. So we can use that experience to empathize. Have you ever felt like you needed to appear stronger than you feel mm-hmm. in the moment? I think we've all had that experience. For someone who has had trauma or poverty, that feeling is just constant, right? So we can relate to it, even if we can't relate to the intensity of it or the duration of it, we can still relate to it. Have you ever felt like something important in your life was out of your control? So often students from trauma and poverty, their behaviors are saying, I am going to take control of this one small thing in my life because I can. Mm-hmm. Because all of these other things, these other parts of my life are out of control. I have no control over them. You know, anyone who applied for grad school mm-hmm. has understood how that can feel, or applied for a job and interviewing for a job. We can understand how that feels to not have control over it. Have you ever felt like something was too hard? Right. Sometimes students from poverty, in particular in areas where students are very transient. So sometimes poverty, kids from poverty, they move a lot. I went to 20 schools, kindergarten through 12th grade. And the movement happens for a variety of reasons. Usually it's job related, maybe eviction related. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So they have gaps. Mm-hmm. They have these kind of big gaps in their learning. And when they come into the English classroom that is at grade level, but they have maybe a second or a third grade reading level, it just feels too hard. Yeah. And so we can all empathize with that. We've all done something that that felt like it was too hard. And we need to try to get them to that next step of how good it feels when we do accomplish something hard. Mm-hmm. Have you ever felt alone? Right? Like nobody could understand what you were going through. Mm-hmm. I think we've all had that experience. Imposter syndrome. If you've ever had imposter syndrome, felt like you were in a room with people and eventually they were going to figure out that you didn't actually belong there. I felt that a lot in my doctoral program, mm-hmm. in my master's program, even like eventually they're going to figure out that I'm not supposed to be here. Have you ever felt like you had to choose between work and family? Mm-hmm. And this is something educators, we make that choice a lot,
yeah,
a lot, because there's so much to do. And so sometimes what students from poverty are choosing between is they're choosing between their family and a culture that they don't necessarily understand. Mm-hmm. Right. And then has anyone ever told you a joke that you didn't get? Mm-hmm. Because you just didn't have the extra information. Our students in poverty, that's sometimes how it feels for them in the classroom. Mm-hmm. They're in the classroom, people are talking about things that they have never experienced before. For me, I was asked to write an essay about describing a family dinner. Mm. My family, we didn't sit down to dinner, mm-hmm. except on holidays. And then it was maybe not a family dinner so much as a family slugfest, you know? Mm-hmm. So our students from poverty, a lot of times that's what they're feeling. They come in and they're like, people are talking about things. I have no idea what they're talking about. We've all experienced that, mm-hmm. right, to some degree or another. And so what we have to do as educators is stop thinking that if we haven't experienced something very extreme, that means we haven't experienced the feeling that accompanies that extreme event. Because we have, mm-hmm. right? It's a human experience. Emotions are human more than anything else. So I have to be careful for myself, and this is kind of a warning too to educators who have experienced trauma and poverty. We have to be careful of comparing our experiences to our student experiences as well, because my version of poverty was not the same as another student's version of poverty. Mm-hmm. Poverty in rural communities is very different than poverty in the inner city. Poverty on I lived on a Pine Ridge Indian Reservation with my first husband for a time, and that's a completely different poverty experience than what I had had. And not everyone who lives in poverty has experienced trauma. Right? So while my poverty experience definitely, trauma was part of that, violence was part of that, child abuse was part of that, drugs and substance abuse was part of that, other families, their poverty experience is very wholesome. They go to church together. They play board games together. They mm-hmm. grow together and love each other. And so I have to sometimes stop myself and say, you know, am I seeing my experience or am I seeing my student's experience mm-hmm. right now? Mm-hmm. If we can see the student's experience and try to get to what they're feeling in that moment, we can empathize with them.
Yeah, and I think that's so important, is to Also not make assumptions, like you said, like, you know, you might have heard bits and pieces about a family of a child that goes to your school, but, you know, don't assume certain things, like the poverty doesn't equal necessarily trauma, right? They could be in a loving family, right? And just those types of things. And I think those were so, you know, thoughtful questions to bring up, like, you know, all of us have had these experiences that, you know, we can resonate with in this situation. And you also talked a little bit in the pre-chat about there is a book called Nickel and Dimed, an anthropologist. Talk about her experience.
One of the best books about the poverty experience that I have read is A Nickel and Dimed. It is by Barbara Ehrenreich, and I'm positive that I'm saying her last name incorrectly. But she went and she took minimum wage jobs, and she kind of explains in this book, like, how much does it cost to be poor? And what are some of the experiences that poor people have, because sometimes their higher ups see them as, you should just be grateful for having a job. And then, you know, I can treat you however I want because you're not that important. And it's one of the best books that I think I've ever read about the poverty experience. A scholar, Dr. Mike Rose, wrote one that is the, I'm forgetting the correct name of it, but The Mind at Work. And so he actually researched, you know, how much cognitive processing is happening with people who are in minimum wage jobs. And so that was a great reminder that, you know, someone who is waiting tables is, they're holding massive amounts of information in their mind all at one time. And then the work of Donna Beagle is, and that's B-E-E-G-L-E. She's a PhD who researches first generation students and poverty and education. And she's she really has some great insight into things that we can do to make our schools more poverty friendly.
Great. Yeah, I'll put those in the show notes as resources for those who'd like to read more. My last question is, how does accepting help or hinder or support your ability to move past trauma? So whether it's a trauma from 30 years ago or a recent trauma that maybe an educator, you know, has lost a family member during COVID or something like that.
Yeah, acceptance. You know, we talk about acceptance in a variety of ways. And I think the first thing is we have to know that acceptance and forgiveness are not always the same thing. Right. So it is okay for us to, like, I have forgiven my parents for what happened to me, but I still have very strong boundaries with my mom. My dad has passed, but my mom, I have very strong boundaries there. And it's okay to have boundaries when we accept what has happened to us. And by acceptance, I mean, we've made that trauma part of who we are. We've recognized that I can't change this thing, but I am changed because of it. Sometimes I talk about my life, you know, as like before Zachary died and after Zachary died, that was a big turning point in my life, because I'm just not the same person. But I'm not the same person as I was before Zachary was born and after Zachary was born, So when we see ourselves as growing human beings, as people who are going to experience things that will change us, and we accept that, that allows us to, you know, prepare ourselves for our own emotional triggers, right? I know if a student comes to me and has had someone in their family commit suicide, and that has definitely happened, I know that is going to trigger some emotional response in me. So I'm able to say in my mind, if a student says this thing to me, I am going to respond with empathy. I am going to tell them I'm there for them. I'm not going to overshadow their current trauma with my past trauma, which is sometimes a temptation. We don't do it on purpose, you know, but we say, I've also experienced this. And sometimes that takes away from the person who's experiencing it right then. If I can accept that, that these things have happened in my life, I am a different person because of it. Then I can help other people see, you know, whether that's my students or my colleagues, you can also get through this, you know, but you have to feel what you're going to feel right now. And then you have to accept that this thing happened to you, and you have to accept the human being you are on the other side of it. Right? Like, I can look back at different points of my life and say, you know, I was this person at this time in my life. I was the student that educators hated when I was in high school. You know, I got very good grades. I was very, very smart. I was the kid that they were like, I wish she would just use her potential, right? Just use her potential. Meanwhile, at lunch, I was out hanging out at the smoker's tree, and I was, you know, getting stoned and going to parties and doing all the things that as educators, we don't want people to do. Mm-hmm. I look back at that human being and I kind of cringe a little bit. But I also have to look back at that human being and accept who she was and how I came to be who I am, because I wouldn't be who I am now without her. Right? Sometimes we get stuck in regret, in fear, in you know, fear of growth. But if we want our students to grow, if we want them to acknowledge that sometimes we're going to make mistakes, so we take risks, we have to share our story of humanity too, right? Like, we all have that time that we don't want to think about. That's probably the time that we should be sharing and accepting.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that sums up perfectly. Like, just, you know, accept, forgive, and, you know, see yourself as a growing human, because there's always going to be challenges, big or small. And the more that people are able to accept that, and know that that's a part of them, like you said, you look back and it was a different person that, you know, you've grown a lot since high school, but, you know, that's a part of you. Well, out of everything we discussed today on the podcast, what's one thing you'd like listeners to remember?
I think the most important thing for us as educators to remember is that we have a lot of power to change lives. That does not necessarily mean that we have the responsibility to change every life. Right? And so when we're doing this work, when we're trying to help kids from poverty, we're trying to help kids from trauma, when we have the student that we just can't make a connection with, instead of taking that personally, right, which is really easy to do, I identify with my ability to connect with my students. And if I have a student that I can't connect with, it makes me feel like a bad teacher. Right? I see myself as a teacher, as a superhero. I think most educators see themselves as needing to be superhuman and needing to be able to do all the things that we're supposed to do. We've got exactly the perfect bulletin boards. We've got exactly the perfect learning targets. They're written on the board every single day. Our lesson plans are super full. Our substitutes always know exactly what they're supposed to, like, the classroom's never cluttered. Although we never have a fight in our classroom, you know, we see all these things. And then when something goes wrong, we think that that makes us a bad teacher. And we think that other people think we're a bad teacher because of it. And right now, particularly post-pandemic, if we can even say we're post-pandemic yet. But I think right now we have a lot of society saying teachers are supposed to be superhuman as well.
Yeah.
And we have to not do that. Don't buy into that, because we're not. We're not superheroes. We're not superhuman. The biggest power that we have with our students is to show them who we actually are as human beings, and how we got here. Because if they never see a person who dropped out of high school, but then has a doctorate degree, right? If they never see a person who experienced the loss of their parents when they were a child and they lived through that, if they never know, you know, that the adults in their lives also had parents who divorced, these kinds of personal stories are the kinds of things we keep to ourselves. But because our students never see it, they make assumptions about their ability to succeed and to move forward. And then we make assumptions about who we are as educators based on students who have never seen what it means to be successful. So if there's one thing I want people to take away, it's, you know, be human. Let your students and your colleagues see you as a human being who faces challenges, who overcomes challenges.
Yeah, that's really important. And like you said, that's so timely with the, you know, the superhero complex and a lot of teachers that are feeling the pressure from society, from maybe within their buildings, and they're always comparing themselves to the teacher down the hall, right?
Yeah. Well, and the reality is that we need the teacher down the hall who teaches in a completely different way than we do, because there will be students we can't connect with, but the teacher down the hall might connect with them. So, you know, if we can accept our own humanity, that gives us permission. It gives us permission to enjoy our job, enjoy our students, help our colleagues make connections, and maybe just enjoy our lives a little bit more too, you know, which is hard to do. It's really hard to do as an educator, you know.
Where can people connect with you and find you online?
So I have a website, www.larinawarnock.net. And I am on Facebook. I am on Twitter as the Doc Knock. Instagram also at the Doc Knock. That's DOCNOCK. That's what my students call me.
Okay. Well, I'll make sure to include that in the show notes. Well, thank you so much for being my guest on the Out of the Trenches podcast today.
Thank you for having me. It was a joy to be here.
Check out the show notes on danagoodyear.com to learn more about this guest and links to their social media. Please subscribe, share, rate, and review wherever you download this podcast. Tell your friends and colleagues about it. And if this episode resonates, especially with you, be sure to share it out on social media and tag me at Out of Trenches PC.